Hey, what's up? What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Periodic Table. This is the show where we break down the science news of the week, every Saturday. We're here with a new panel of amazing hosts. I'm, of course, your main host, Brandon Hanna. This is youtube.com/Brandon Hanna, of course. I am a mechanical engineer with about 9 years of experience in the aerospace industry. You might know me as a host for AfterBuzz TV, the Popcorn Talk Network, or you might have seen me in the movie Trivia Schmodown. But alas, I have two amazing guests here with me also, both of which you might have seen from the PJ Campbell Network, who you've had. We've had PJ on the show here before. Amazing fellow. And I've poached some of his incredible talent, starting off with, you might know him, he is a theater producer and, of course, a big shot over at the PJ Campbell Network. It is Maxwell Haddad.
Hello. Happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday. You know, I never quite know how to pronounce your last name because I grew up with a baseball coach spelled exact the same way, but he preferred it pronounced Haddad.
I like Haddad as well.
So does Max.
Awesome. The inclination is to go more Middle Eastern with it and go Haddad or Haddad, but I've always done Haddad. Honestly, it's a point of contention amongst my siblings and I. We all have a preferred way. I like Haddad. Keep it simple.
Awesome. Perfect. So what you're getting to is PJ Campbell has lied to me every time he's announced you on one of his shows.
So have I. I've never gotten it right. Even though I know how to say it, I've never gotten it right.
He's never gotten it right. You might also know him from the PJ Campbell Network and the Movie Trivia Schmodown. He is what you call a Star Wars expert. It's Sean Sullivan.
Expert is a strong term, but the only time this has ever been relevant in my small YouTube career, I am also a telecommunications technician, so I do know a little bit about some sciencey stuff. Never brought that up on camera, so there you go. I'm a telecommunications technician.
There you go.
If the viewers at home are wondering what my science background is, I failed chemistry in 11th grade and had to write a research paper over the summer in order to get credits for the class.
Yes, but what I think you're missing is one of Master Yoda's great teachings, which is the greatest teacher failure is. So therefore, that makes you the biggest expert out of all of us. All right. Well, we have an amazing show for you guys today. Three amazing topics, of course. You know the drill. Two main topics, one special segment, the first of which, giant worms have burrowed into the ancient seafloor to ambush prey, and German scientists make paralyzed mice walk again. What are the implications there? And this week's special segment, I titled it, Let's Get Social. What is going on with TikTok's sea shanty trend? That's right, we are getting into TikTok on this show. But before we do all that, let's bounce right back up to the top. And we are talking about these giant worms in the ancient seafloor ambushing prey. Or as the thumbnail points out, I'm pretty sure right as they did it, they yelled out, "Surprise, fish!" And they had their lunch. So guys, around 20 million years ago, giant ocean worms may have burrowed into the seafloor and burst forth like the space slug from Star Wars. Hear that, Sean? Star Wars. An exogorth. See, I didn't even have to ask you to tell me what it was. I knew you would just know it immediately.
I forgot its name. It's got a name. I don't remember it. It'll never get asked.
It'll never get asked. Famous last words of the movie Trivia Showdown. So yeah, these space slugs, ancient sea worms ambushed prey, and there are trace fossils left behind that now, all these years later, scientists are beginning to uncover. And guys, this is an article from Science News. Of course, the links to all the articles talked about on this show are in the description down below if you'd like to read and get more information for yourself. So guys, ancient underground layers left behind by these animals appear in rocks from coastal Taiwan. Researchers report on January 21st, the diggers may have been analogs in that context. That's an interesting use of that word. I'm not familiar with. Analogs of modern bobbit worms, known for burying themselves in the sand to surprise and strike their prey. and I was tempted. I think I'm going to do it. There is a video along with this article of the Bobbit Worm in action.
Yes. Yes.
And I think it would be quite appropriate if we played it here today and did a bit of a commentary for you all.
Let's do it. Without
I was literally watching that video as you spoke because it's so good.
All righty. And here it is. So there is the Bobbit Worm. It does kind of look like the space slug from Star Wars.
It does. It really does.
It's also kind of funny. They're picky eaters because it's got food right there, but it doesn't want that food. It wants the big boy.
Oh.
Ooh.
It goes for the big boy.
Wow.
You can hear the sound of the fish. Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about that. I watched it without sound before the show, guys.
I did, too.
Kind of, like, gruesome and violent.
It's a little gruesome and violent, but I thought, who better to share this with?
In a way, I find very engaging. Look at this. Oh, my God.
So the idea is that the fossil specimens they found are what? 100 times larger than these Bobbit Worms?
Is that what it said in the article? I'm a little distracted by the violence on my screen right now.
Well, they call them giant ocean worms. When I think giant ocean worm, like these things have got to be like this big, right? Those
right.
Like, that fish can't be more than maybe, 7 inches. How fucking big is a giant? I did it. I said the word. how big is a giant ocean worm? I mean, are we talking something that could fight Godzilla or Kong? Or are we talking like, 12 feet? Either way, those are big.
They had also found significantly large tunnels that these worms had built. So we're talking about some sizable worms.
Yeah, I believe the article says that the burrows discovered from 319 fossil specimens, 2 meters long and only 2 to 3 centimeters wide. So not utterly terrifying.
Well, I mean, definitely terrifying, but not, threat to society terrifying.
I mean, still longer than me. I like to think I'm a little wider than 3 centimeters in diameter, but that's a long worm.
That's a
real
long worm. How do we feel about the depths of the ocean floor? Because I don't think anything scares me more than that.
So,
it's quite terrifying.
I am scuba certified.
Oh.
It's been a while since I've been diving, although it's something I've been wanting to get back into. I've been about 100 feet deep before, which is like medium range difficulty. I wasn't... like pro certified, but I was very good and very comfortable, and it is scary, but looking back on like everything I've experienced in my life, I've rarely felt as peaceful as when I'm down underneath the ocean. There's just something about being amongst the sea life, and especially when you're like down in the Caribbean where the water is so clear and you have good visibility, because I've also been scuba diving in a lake where I couldn't even see my hand if it was here. That was scary when you can't see anything. But I wouldn't want to get in a thing and be like, James Cameron and go like to the abyss. Like, that's okay.
But that's a little much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
who knows what depths may be lurking down there, cause we don't go down that deep ever. So there may be all sorts of stuff that we don't understand. I'm far more scared of space than I am of the ocean.
And now, as we've pointed out, there are these types of worms in space, according to the documentary Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back.
Or the noted documentary Dune.
Yes.
Or Tremors.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep making those documentaries, so that problem is still very, very...
They apparent. Do. There's been so many Tremors. At the end of each one, I'm like, oh, looks like they solved the problem. And then, nope, they're still tremming.
They're still tremming, just like the modern Bobbit Worm.
Yes.
Seal their 3 meter long bodies in sand and surge forth to grab unsuspecting prey with their scissor like teeth. And we just saw a video like that. The oldest evidence of such worms comes from the early Paleozoic era, which is around 400 million years ago. How these Bobbit Worms relate to the ones discovered in these fossils remains to be unknown, But however, if ancient bobbit worms did terrorize the seafloor back then, their burrows are a rare example of invertebrates hunting vertebrates. Usually, it's the other way around. I found that particularly interesting about this article. Maxwell, did you find this one fact interesting? And are there any other parts of this article that caught your attention?
I did find that interesting because it made me picture a bobbit worm or one of these ancient worms large enough to suck me up. I am a vertebrate. I have a vertebrae. And the idea of a worm that could just suck me up and eat me is terrifying. Like I'm scared enough of lions and tigers and bears, oh my, but like a big old worm, like you think normally a worm cannot prey on a mouse or other vertebrates. Right. So, but then you watch that video of the bobbit worm sucking up that fish and it's sort of like, whoa, that's very odd. I did find this interesting. You know, obviously, like I said, I have a particular interest in the ocean and the sea. I love sea life and sea creatures, especially the non-scary ones. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to get in a cage and go mingle with the great white shark. I'm not that kind of guy. But the notion of these giant worms creating tunnels and preying. But what I found particularly interesting, other than the vertebrate thing, was when these researchers were doing their study, one of the things they found was fossilized poop.
Yeah.
And the notion that our poop could live on for 20 million years, or that these worms' poop lives on for 20 million years, is particularly interesting to me.
Yeah, because, you know, when you look at this article, they talk about how obviously an animal that was an invertebrate has no skeleton, which makes it a lot more difficult to leave behind fossilized remains. It does have that razor sharp teeth, but those are very easily lost in the sand, ground up, spread over a distance to where it's very difficult to recover the remains. But what was left behind was, of course, fossilized poop, fossilized footprints, if you will, obviously. This is a worm. It doesn't have any feet, but what it does have is these burrows that it used to dig in the seabed. And that is what has been fossilized, is that they found evidence of these burrows, these tunnels, if you will. And similar to the bobbit worm, they were able to see that there's kind of like a funnel at the top of the burrow, which shows what we just saw in that video, that they would drag their prey down into the seabed itself, which is pretty scary. So Sean, I want to throw it over to you next. Did anything else stand out to you in this article that you found particularly interesting, or is there anything that I just mentioned you would like to elaborate on?
You know, the vertebrate invertebrate thing did kind of shock me, because I think the only invertebrate that really is large enough to play on significant vertebrates would be what, a giant squid, a colossal squid. It's kind of the only thing large enough to hunt real vertebrates. But I mean, just the whole concept of this, the concept that we're able to find this in the depths of the ocean is kind of what blows my mind, you know, to begin with, because we don't even know how much is lost down there just by the inaccessibility of, you know, it's underwater, we can't breathe, and the pressure is so strong. Like, how much have we lost to time just being buried down there? You know, I mean, that's kind of what blows me away. And the video of that damn worm.
That is probably the most shocking thing of all. And it's interesting how there is a modern day comparison of a creature that we can take a look at and see a similar survival predatory tactics. For me, overall, obviously, like we said, an invertebrate hunting vertebrate is very interesting to me. And also just how they were able to uncover fossilized remains, and trace fossils more is the accurate term, of a creature that didn't have a skeleton to leave behind. And they were able to find these tunnels, and it's like, well, what makes this different than any ordinary tunnel? It's like, congratulations, you found an ancient tunnel. It could be anything. But researchers were able to take a closer look and come to these conclusions, because these tunnels, it says in the article, they lacked the hallmark pellets lining crustacean tunnels and had a smoother lining than bivalve tunnels. I hope I pronounced that right. Iron deposits along the inside suggest that the digger must have been long and slendered and used mucus to reinforce the walls. And of course, we talked about the funneling at the top of the burrows, but this also points to the ancient worm emerging from its hideout, retreating, and then rebuilding the top section of the tunnel over and over again. So it sounds like these ancient worms took good care of their tunnels, lined the inside with mucus, was constantly rebuilding the tunnels after the tunnels would get all messed up once they caught prey. So it's interesting, I think, fascinating, really, to see from this evidence that they were able to come to these conclusions and the amount of care that this creature took into their tunnel. I think that's very interesting. What about you, Max? What would you agree?
It makes you question their level of intelligence, you know, because theoretically you would think a worm or something related to a worm. And by the way, I just like to note the fact that there is a creature now that shares a lot of similarities is just further fuel in the fire that evolution is a very real thing. Science. But, you know, the fact that they would not only put so much care, but would rebuild their tunnels, keep them smooth. Obviously, they had good awareness of what was going on and a decent level of intelligence, despite being worms. And that's interesting. More people who build things should put that much care into them. I think some general contractors could learn a lesson or two from these ancient sea worms.
I would be inclined to agree. And I think another little factoid that I found fascinating was that this actually poses a lot more questions for the scientific community. It means that the ancient oceans, the ecosystem was a lot more complex than what was previously, they were previously led to believe. So this just kind of opens the door, I think, for even more scientific discoveries and a better understanding of an ancient ecosystem and how, what can we do with that knowledge to learn more about our modern day ecosystem.
I watched a really excellent documentary that really illustrated to me the complexities of the seafloor. It's called Shark Tale.
And that's the one directed by Martin Scorsese?
He appears in it, but he didn't direct it. I was just fascinated. Wow, I didn't know sea fish had such pronounced eyebrows.
That is true.
I learned so many things from these great National Geographic style documentaries.
Sean, do you have any more nonsensical things to say, or are we ready to move on to our second topic?
Can I just say, if for everyone watching at home, look up the bobbit worm and get a picture of this of what they look like in still form. They've got these big ugly mandibles that just crush. This thing is freaking scary. I mean,
well, it's got to be so strong too.
Yeah, because it's got to just pull everything in. But
they, how much pressure, like force of pressure, they could get with their mandibles.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah. Well, but they do have beautiful iridescent skin, which is kind of neat. Little rainbow pattern.
Just like you.
No, I'm not sparkly. That's vampires, which aren't real. Are they? Wait, Brandon, you're the scientist here. Are vampires real?
You weren't supposed to know. But you know what? Let's move on to something a little more optimistic than vampires. But before we do that, I just want to thank everyone we have in the live chat right now watching and learning along with us. We, of course, have Haskell420, BCD, Michael Chu, Luann Olasiewicz. That is my Aunt Luann, guys. Hello, welcome. And Sabrina Ramirez and Brandon Buckingham. Welcome, Brandon Buckingham.
What's up, Buck?
To the show. I hope you guys are all having fun. This is a sillier episode than we normally have, but that's okay because sometimes it is okay to have fun when talking about science. You know what?
It's okay to have fun for that, and I apologize.
No need to apologize. It's okay to have fun every time you talk about science. But let's move on. We do have what I think is this past article was fun, interesting. We learned about the ancient seafloor. This next one is a bit more serious, a bit more optimistic, and I think has a lot of possible implications that I'd love to discuss. And this is reported by NBC News. German scientists make paralyzed mice walk again. So, wow, right off the bat, it says here in the article, German researchers have enabled mice paralyzed after spinal cord injuries to walk again, reestablishing a neural link hitherto considered irreparable in mammals by using a designer protein. And I think that's the key takeaway here, a designer protein that is injected into the brain. So before I start rambling off with more facts, because you know I love to do that, let's throw it over to you, Sean. What was your overall first impression when reading this article?
I mean, my overall first impression is just how cool this is. I mean, the article does go into say, like, we don't know how it'll work on larger mammals, but let's say we are able to get it to work. It's wonderful. The other question, big question I have is, will it work on degenerative disorders as opposed to just injuries? Because I know a lot of people are, you know, born or grow to lose control of certain limbs or certain other things. You know, will this apply, or is it only for injuries? I don't know. Like, that was kind of the two big things that I had taken away from this. You know, the other thing that I was thinking was, like, it mentions how long it's going to take to investigate all this. No, put all our money into this. This is what we need to figure out. Like, this is why we need to fund science. Yeah, that's my first two big takeaways.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It says here in the article, it specifically mentions spinal cord injuries in humans, and they often are either from sport or traffic accidents. And it leaves humans paralyzed because not all of the nerve fibers that carry information between muscles and the brain are able to grow back. And it looks like this designer protein injected into the brain is able to actually grow these nerve fibers back, these critical nerve fibers that carry information from the brain and the muscles. So if that's the case, if they're able to, like they mentioned, that they want to move on to larger mammals like dogs and primates, on from mice and even pigs, and then eventually go on to human trials once they're confident it's a little more safe. And like you said, it can take a long time. They mentioned it could take years, many, many years for them to even get to that point. Maxwell, I want to throw this over to you now. Do you think that this is something that we can be hopeful and optimistic about, or are there maybe some concerns, some potential drawbacks that we need to seriously be considering?
I mean, you know, just on its face, I found this very sort of mind-blowing and inspiring. Obviously, you know, like Sean said, cases like this are always signs that funding science research, and especially science as it relates to medical research, is of vital interest. You know, you hear things about DNA cloning and designer proteins or even stem cell research, and there are certain ethical concerns, and not to mention ethical concerns that may arise in animal testing. But the mere notion that they were able to unparalyze a previously paralyzed mouse is kind of remarkable. And the interesting thing to me is, you know, especially when you're dealing with, say, a spinal injury, I didn't put necessarily cognizantly notice that it would be a neural link that was causing the issue. Mm-hmm. You would just think it's, you know, similar to a broken bone where something is so injured that it stops working. But it makes so much sense that it's a neural link that's causing the problem. And if you could somehow reconnect it, like literally in basic terms, plugging it back in to your brain so your brain can operate it again. Because, you know, my hand is moving now because my brain is telling it to move. That's sort of the mind-blowing thing about a functioning human being. So the notion that you could design something to be injected into your brain to reawaken that connection, I mean, the potential implications of it and what it could, I mean, as they continue to research and develop what it could also be designed to help with, is really incredible. And I do think we're sort of living in an age of medical, a renaissance of innovation. That's the word I was looking for, in medicine. You know, especially with being able to 3D print stuff like that. So it's all sort of connected in that as technology evolves, and then they find ways to use that technology to heal people. You know, because I also wonder, even if someone's not paralyzed, but if they have, you know, nonstop back pain or a knee injury that, you know, that just can't ever get better, or they had torn their ACL, stuff like that. If there are, you know, deviations of these designer proteins that could be injected to fix those issues too. It's really the possibilities boggle the mind. I don't pretend to be a doctor or a scientist, but just theorizing myself makes me question what people who are far more educated about these topics could theorize. So it's exciting to see. And I hope, you know, if they do test it in larger mammals, that they do it safely and ethically, and that they have good results. Because just imagine, you know, you see these dogs that have back problems and end up in wheelchairs. Imagine if they could fix that, the quality of life they could reinstill in these dogs who are hurt, and on to a horse, and then to a human, or a monkey or an orangutan. It's just sort of gives me chills just to think about.
Yeah, it is absolutely incredible. I think probably the biggest revelation here is they're not trying to directly treat the spine or the spinal cord. They're injecting this designer protein into the brain, which allows them they use the term like relatively small intervention. They're able to stimulate a very large number of nerves to regenerate by actually going in through the brain, which I think is a very important takeaway. And, you know, they even say in the article that the paralyzed rodents that received the treatment started walking only after 2 to 3 weeks. So I don't know how that translates to larger animals. If the larger the mammal, the longer the recovery time. I think that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure, but wow, just 2 to 3 weeks to go from being not paralyzed or being paralyzed to not paralyzed is quite remarkable. They also mentioned the treatment involves injecting carriers of genetic information into the brain to produce the protein. And this is called, just because I haven't tried to pronounce a word that's hard to pronounce in a few moments, and I want to give myself another chance, hyperinterleukin 6. So that is what that's called. Thank you. Go on, Sean.
That also may be a question of dosage, though, as far as like how long it takes, because on a larger mammal, you can give a larger dosage, right? I mean, so that may also kind of contribute to the healing time. But the fact that, like, because when I first read this, and like, all these articles I kind of went through a couple times because I didn't want to miss anything. When I first read this, I was kind of thinking like, oh, okay, so they just inject something into the spine and it, you know, acts as sort of a buffer fluid and slowly that regenerates. And then I reread it and it said that the fact that this is going to our central nervous system as opposed to the spine directly and triggering this regenerative healing, what else could these designer proteins and other types of, you know, scary genetic science, like what else can we do? Can we just inject and change our eye color? Because look, you know, I like my eyes, but I could get red eyes. That's great. I'm in. Sign me up.
Gattaca. Now you're talking about Gattaca.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's kind of a very science fiction, concept with this, because, you know, it's that whole idea that our bodies are just genetic code as opposed to computer code. We can manipulate that in certain ways, which is awesome, but it's also at a certain point playing God a little bit. Not that I'm like hyper religious or anything, but you know, at a certain point it kind of is playing God, and where's the line at which it, you know, becomes scary. I don't know.
Yeah, it certainly is. It can be scary. Science can be scary sometimes, especially we are at a point, I think, in the world of science where we are beginning to make these types of discoveries, these types of inventions. You know, we've been talking about the potential of the quantum internet and using drones to transmit the internet across the world. We're talking about repairing formerly irreparable spinal damage with an injection into the brain. We've been talking about gene editing on this show, all kinds of crazy stuff. It is a great time to be talking about science, but it's also a scary time. Even, you know, there are obviously doubts amongst people with vaccines, which obviously don't be an anti-vaxxer, guys. Be better than that. But, you know, it's all about communicating. We've talked about that on this show too, being able to scientists communicating, having public education, talking to the people about what exactly these things mean. Like, okay, you're going to take the vaccine, but you know, there might be a couple side effects, but these are what they're going to be, and they're going to be gone in this X amount of days. And this is what the vaccine is actually doing to make sure that you've severely lowered your chances of getting this certain type of disease. And so now if we do get to a point where we are injecting something into someone's brain to make them be able to walk again, that is something that there's going to be need to be. And I think Alex Marzonia said this really well on last week's show. There needs to be some sort of public education to let people know. And so that rumors, fake news, you know, misleading claims about science don't get spread out when we can be at the forefront of educating people. So I think it is scary, and I did go off on a little bit of a tangent there, but I think it's very important for us to be talking about science optimistically, be transparent, talk about our concerns, voice our concerns, come up with our own little theories and hypotheses. But yeah, this is a crazy, crazy thing. So
I can, as far as the public education thing goes, I can't tell you how many times in my daily job, in my job daily, that I get customers asking me about 5G internet and whether it causes cancer.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I can't.
Yep.
Yeah, we like for as normal as like technology and science, literally, like, I don't know about you guys, but maybe you guys have smart devices, a Ring doorbell, like everything's Wi-Fi enabled in your home. The fact that we're doing this right here, like our whole lives are like ingrained in science now and technology. And the fact that there's this level of like mysticism behind the everyday technology we use to the point where people think that 5G is causing cancer. Like, yeah, sure. Technically, it's radiation. It's a radio wave at a very, very high frequency. It's at a very, very high frequency. It degrades at a high rate. It's not enough to actually cause harm. It's still less powerful than your microwave. Sure, if you stand in your microwave, you're going to get cooked, technically dehydrated. But, like, it's not the... I'm done. That's my.
That's a fair point from Sean Sullivan, expert on microwaves, which I did not expect but appreciate.
There's a reason why they used to call it the science oven.
Yeah, and that's something that we take for granted today. Most of us have it in our kitchens. I personally don't. I got a very small kitchen. Unfortunately, no room for a microwave, but that's okay. We manage. But yeah, this is something that used to have a lot of skepticism, a lot of mysticism behind it. Now people just are like, oh yeah, the microwave, you know, we all have one, we all use one, you don't really think about it. So it's important. And like I said, we've talked about a lot of things on this show that I think is summed up perfectly about what Maxwell said about we are in a renaissance of science innovation, and we are at the forefront of a lot of new groundbreaking discoveries and invention, and it's important for us to talk about it. And that's what this show is just all about, us talking, us learning, us growing together, and becoming all little scientists in our own right, except for Sean, who's already an expert on microwaves and space slugs.
When will you be sending me my little scientist lapel pin?
It will be in the mail in 2 to 3 weeks, which is about the same amount of time another mouse will miraculously get its spine repaired.
That makes me happy. You know, assuming that there are no detrimental side effects and the mice are being treated ethically and with respect.
Yeah, that was something reading the article was also at the forefront of my mind is I hope that these animals are being treated ethically. I like to assume that they are, because, you know, these mice have broken backs, mm-hmm. essentially. So I don't know if they're all little mice Batman and little mice Bane is just walking around doing his thing or not. I'm not entirely sure how they get these mice, but I hope that the treatment is as ethical and as safe as possible. And it does seem like at least once they get somewhat close to human trials, they are going to try to be as ethical and safe as possible, which is why they're taking their time, I think, with this. And of course, funding is probably a certain factor, like Sean said, you know, like throw all the money at this. This is a big deal, guys. Yeah. Like this can change lives. And even if we can't get this technology to a point, at least not in the relatively near future, where we're fixing human spines, like imagine, like you said, Max, like having a sick dog who's got a spinal condition, or like a cat or someone like a beloved pet who has a spinal condition that can be repaired in a matter of weeks, as opposed to having to live a life struggling, or worse, even having to put that beloved pet down. This can change lives, so many lives for the better, even if it doesn't even get to the point of human trials, which right. I think is important.
Well, and on top of that, even if it doesn't work in humans, it's still going to increase our knowledge of how our nervous system works, and, you know, the mystery of the human body. You know, the fact of the matter is, like, we are a machine. There's a way that we work. We are, whether you believe in intelligent design or pure evolution or whatever, like we are a you know, working machine. Why do we work? Right? That there's no reason for us to work. Why is that? And this is the kind of thing that, like, you know, humans above most of the animal kingdom have the ability to speak and communicate, and, you know, we're not on an instinctual level. We're on a, you know, whatever we are on, we're all learned mannerisms for the most part. So why is that? And this, like, that all stems back to the nervous system. And that's essentially what this is looking at, you know, how we can grow our nervous system. There's so much in this article about this little feel good piece about mice. There's so much in here to dig deeper into, and throw all the money at it. Like, seriously, please.
The most exciting thing to me about science, especially science innovation, is what that innovation could lead to thereafter. Because, mm-hmm. like Sean said, even if theoretically this doesn't end up working for humans, it's still a breakthrough and will still chart the course for how to navigate further advancements, whether that be in healing or gene or nerve therapy, that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, certainly. So a lot to hopefully look forward to in the future, and we'll have to keep an eye on this story and see how it progresses going forward. So with all that being said, let's talk about something that I think is particularly silly, but believe it or not, there is science behind it. So let's get social. What is going on with TikTok's sea shanty trend? I know, Sean, you are just super excited to talk about this one. This is coming from inverse.com. And well, guys, more than 10 months stuck at home is enough to give anyone wanderlust. But on TikTok, the urge to be out in the wilds is manifesting in an unexpected way, a viral obsession with sea shanties. So guys, this TikTok sea shanty trend, so I guess before I throw it to you, let's give a little background. This article is kind enough to give a little background for the people watching at home who might not be as versed in TikTok as I know that the three of us are. TikTok is a beloved platform for its ability to serve up videos to cater to every niche imaginable, from viral dance moves, Chandra Dandapani, to the forest foraging and adorable frog cakes. But perhaps one of the platform's most magical quirks is its ability to propel one obscure video into a viral trend, which takes over all of TikTok's niches at once, creating an exploding fractal of riffs. Fractal, that's a nice use of that word. Duet and reimagining, and that is exactly what happened when Nathan Evans, a 26-year-old Scottish postman, shared a video of him singing and stomping the beat to an old sea shanty called Soon May the Wellerman Come. The song itself is about the grisly practice of hunting and butchering a whale. But for many on TikTok, it seemed to represent a kind of nostalgic yearning for community that has been hard to come by in quarantine. And in 2 weeks since posting this rendition, there's been thousands of duets, including one by Kermit the Frog. And of course, people making sea shanties all on their own, inspired by different songs. I believe says something here about All Star by Smash Mouth. There's been a rendition. So this is just, this is something. There's actually science behind this, guys, believe it or not. But before I get into it, Sean, I know you were excited to talk about some of your favorite
seasons. Okay, so
throw it to you.
So Maxwell, my close personal friend Maxwell, who is here. Maxwell, say hi to the chat.
Hello, chat.
Okay. Maxwell and our other friend Dan Nye sent us a grip of these sea shanties, and I'll be honest with you, I wasn't that interested because I heard one and then the next one just sounded the same and the next one sounded the same. Like, I like sea shanties, as you can tell. I'm kind of a, you know, medieval geek, whatever. But you know, I was like, okay, it's the same song just sung a bunch of different ways. Like, yeah, they're good, but I don't do TikTok. I don't understand TikTok. I've tried to pay Abby to teach me what TikTok is and she won't. This article points out the All-Star sea shanty, so I had to go hear that. And then after that, I had to go hear, linked under that was the Another One Bites the Dust sea shanty, which is just pure joy. That's what I got. I don't understand TikTok. I don't understand the sea shanty trend, but I'm glad it's a trend.
Maxwell, what about you? Has this trend changed your life for the better? What do you feel about sea shanties?
So first of all, I wouldn't call myself like a super TikTok user, but I do watch it every couple of days and find myself getting trapped in like a couple hour long hole because you just, and for those, there seems to be a little confusion in the chat. TikTok is a social platform, not dissimilar from Vine, if you remember Vine, where you can post videos, although these can be up to a minute, I believe. People have gotten quite famous on TikTok, and the fun thing is you can do duets. So like if Brandon made a video where he's talking about science, I can then click duet and then it would sort of do a split screen of me reacting to, or in the case of the sea shanty singing, like say a harmony or a bass part to whatever Brandon is singing. So when I first got wind of the sea shanty trend, I don't know, last week or the week before, I naturally became curious, and the Wellerman song in particular has been stuck in my head in such a significant way. But and I've listened to remixes. There's like EDM versions of it. There's all these different duets that are so fun. And then, you know, I started exploring deeper into the various sea shanties, and they're so fun. And I've actually found them very comforting. And reading this article illuminated to me why that might be. So the two things that stuck out to me is, so, you know, going back to the origin of sea shanties, you know, you're picturing guys working on a ship. The rhythm of the songs helped them keep in rhythm with the work they were doing. So it was sort of a secondary action to say, if they're hammering nails or, you know, pulling up the sail, whatever it is, that would keep it. But it also builds a sense of community and puts everyone on the same page. And I think that's why the sea shanties have become so prevalent now. Like you said, we're going on 10 months of being locked down and quarantined. You know, certainly different people have had different levels of that. Some of us are at work. Some of us, you know, go out a little bit. But generally speaking, society has been at a significantly reduced functionality to before. And I think the big thing we're all missing is human contact, interaction, and a sense of community. And so the sea shanties, and in particular the duets, I think have reinstilled a sense of community on something that's powerful and optimistic and is connecting people. So what you would see these duets where it'd be like one person and then another, and you would end up with like 12 different little split screens. They're all doing different parts, tenor, bass, countertenor, alto, soprano, beatboxing, this, that, and the other thing, making something that sounds harmonious. It was a way to use TikTok and the internet and then music to create digital community. So when I put that together reading this article, I was like, this makes so much more sense than it just being a fad of, oh yeah, this week we're listening to sea shanties. It became a sense of community. It became interactive. And I found that really powerful in its own way, because there's a lot of crap on TikTok. And then there's also some really good stuff. And this, I think, has been one of the more exciting things.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. And I think that was very well put. The article does refer to these sea shanties as earworms, which I thought was very appropriate with today's show. We've got seabed worms, sea shanties being earworms. There's a connection there. I'm not entirely sure what it is, but I just wanted to make note of that. But like you said, the article points out there was actually research done in 2015, published in the journal Cognitive Science, found that rhythmic music like sea shanties has the potential to enhance interpersonal motor coupling. Very well said, Maxwell. This is really all about creating a community. Like you said, sea shanties, the rhythmic motion is used to help people bond, help them work together in rhythm. And there's scientific studies, scientific reports. Researchers in Australia looked at brain activity and EEGs to observe how human beings are affected by these rhythmic music. Some people are able to move in sync to a beat all by themselves. Some need external stimulation. So when looking like on a boat at sea, we can definitely see how these songs are able to help people more effectively work and bond together. So there's a kind of like a closing little paragraph on this article that sums things up pretty well. And it says, while thousands of individuals across TikTok are unlikely to come together in person anytime soon, we all hope not. Stay home, kids. To haul rope or swing hammers. Okay, well, maybe if you're doing something fun like that, you can consider it. Just kidding. There is something to be said about the social camaraderie such songs can promote. What's curious here is the fact that such bonding can take place via an online platform rather than among workers together in a team or in a church choir. And at a time, of course, when gathering together in person isn't an option, perhaps singing sea shanties together online is the next best thing for our well-being. So what I'm taking here is we need to stop this show altogether and solely focus on our sea shanties, and we'll be better off for it. Would you agree, Sean?
I agree. I very much agree. I for one, am going to quit my job. I'm going to quit the Schmodown. I'm just sea shanties all day, every day. Max, send word to PJ. I'm leaving the network. I've got to become a shanter. Shantyman?
Oh. Troubadour.
Troubadour. You know what I was thinking when I got to, when we actually get to the science bit of this article, I found it really interesting that like we see across other cultures that same kind of rhythmic, you know, musical thing. With, you know, African, a lot of African cultures have stuff like that. Like Gregorian chants to a certain extent are that same rhythmic, you know, drive. We see with, you know, Native American, certain ritual culture with that. And the haka in, what is that? Maori, New Zealand?
New Zealand, yeah.
Yeah, the haka, like very much kind of that same thing. Yeah, which, you know, it was a trend in the mid-2000s for high school football teams to do that, that now I realize is not okay.
It's a little bit of unnecessary cultural appropriation.
No, so I will not be reenacting that now, even though I know how to. I feel like it's just, it's long past that that time. but yeah, that was the first thing that came to mind. Was like, well, yeah, like before football games, we used to do the haka, and then we have other chants that we did, you know, to kind of get everyone in, you know, in sync. No pun intended with the, you know,
Justin
band. Yeah. So yeah, I definitely, like, for me in through sports and other things, like, I've experienced this and I think it's definitely applicable. Yeah, that's what I got. I don't know. I don't know how to end a thought. So I just start rambling.
It's okay. Sometimes I don't know either. But yeah, like, I think you did make a good point, though, that's outlined in this article, is that we've seen this type of rhythmic singing, whistling, humming in many different cultures, many different areas of the workforce, obviously from sailors out at sea. It says here in the article, men working on the railroads back in the day, hammering down spikes, unionizers, and even they speculate that children's lullabies evolved from similar work songs as well. And they even say, because parenting, after all, is a form of work, especially for stay-at-home parents. So yeah, I thought this was a fun little special segment today for us to explore TikTok, get some of the younger generation watching this show, get you guys interested in talking about science. But yeah, I think this was a fun show, guys. Thank you so much for joining me for this installment of the Periodic Table. I hope you had fun. I know that the people watching at home enjoyed having you on. And like I said, none of us are experts, guys, except for Sean, knows a lot about Star Wars. But none of us are experts. We are learning along with you, the audience. Yes, I have experience as a mechanical engineer, but I don't know anything about sea shanties. I don't know anything about giant worms underneath the ocean. And I certainly don't know anything about making mice be able to walk again. That's all a little above my pay grade. I learned all this stuff with you today. And that's the point of this show, guys. We are learning, we are talking, we're speculating. We're not always going to get everything 100% right, but it's all about having the conversation anyway, which is the key takeaway here. So before we wrap up, is there any, you know, this was your first time on the show, both Maxwell and Sean. Is there any closing final words about today's show or science in general that you would like to share with the audience at home? Maxwell looks eager. Let's start with you.
I would like to quote Channing Tatum in 21 Jump Street. Science!
Perfect.
I just wanted to say that, you know, if you like this type of content and if you like learning about science and you like interacting with the scientific content, you can always check out Brandon Hanna's Patreon over at patreon.com/. I'm not sure. It's not in the video description.
No. patreon.com/Brandon Hanna. I don't promote it maybe as much as I should, guys. I like to, you know, keep things about science, but while I'm here, I do have a Patreon. I don't offer much, but it does help me a long way with being able to get this content out to you all. Some of the benefits: I am doing a monthly live stream that I like to call Brandon Hanna Live. I should probably get going on that soon. More information to come. But if you are a patron at a certain level, you can join me on that stream, and we're going to talk about whatever's going on in the world of pop culture, cinema, science, news, you name it. We'll figure it out. And of course, I actually have a Discord if you all want to join at even the lowest level, the $3 level. I do have a Discord for us to all just kind of start forming a community over there. And while I'm at it, because I did not plug it earlier, guys, it's not Christmas. Christmas isn't over until I say it's over. I am still working hard at editing the Film Physics Christmas special. It's all about Die Hard. Hoping to get that wrapped up this weekend, believe it or not. I keep hearing a lot of things like, Brandon, it's January 23rd. Brandon, it's almost Valentine's Day. And I'm saying, what are you talking about? John McClane needs to stop these terrorists in Nakatomi Plaza. And Christmas isn't over until he does. So guys, please keep a lookout for that. If you are a patron of mine, you will get it earlier than the general public. So keep that in mind. I've been rambling on too much. I don't know where I am right now, but thank you so much for being here today. Madness that happens over in the world of Boxbox, I think has made its way over to the periodic table.
That's our fault. We're sorry.
No, it's okay. That show's a little different every week. And it was super great to have you guys. Thank you so much for joining me. I super duper appreciate it. Maxwell, let's go over to you first. If the people want to see what you're up to, see what you're doing online, maybe ask you questions about sea shanties, where can the good people watching find you?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed talking about the topics. I love the show. I like watching it. I always learn something new every week, so to be a part of it was a thrill. And getting to share with my good friend Sean was just extra special. You can find me on Twitter, like it says right here, at Cinemaxwell. That's also my Letterboxd handle. My Instagram handle is Cinemaxwell Inc. I-N-C. You can find me most nights on the PJ Campbell Network. We do watch-alongs. We do... I host a show called Front Center Mezzanine every other Thursday where we interview people who work in the theater community. That's a passion of mine that I love. And also starting this Tuesday, Dwayne Burke, who I'm sure most of you know, and I are hosting a new show called Book Nook. This is a monthly book club style show where each month we introduce a book about a month prior. Hopefully people who will read it as well. And then Dwayne and I and our special guest, who this month just so happens to be Sean Sullivan, we'll be talking about the first book in the Ranger's Apprentice series, The Runes of Gorlan. It's going to be a lot of fun. That's on Tuesday. We're going to do that at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific.
All right. So, guys, definitely go check all that wonderful stuff out that Maxwell works so very hard on. He does an amazing job and deserves your support. Someone who might not deserve. No, I'm just kidding. Sean. I don't where can the people find you online? What are you up to? Plug away.
Occasionally on the PJ Campbell Network, I show up about twice a week, depending on what's going on, where I also host a show called Box Box. We've got an exciting new episode coming soon. And next month, I think the viewers will all enjoy our guest next month. Not that this month isn't going to be an enjoyable guest, but you know what I mean. And then I'm on Twitch at twitch.tv/SeanSully, where I stream as much as I can, despite the fact that I haven't done it in like 2 weeks, not counting last night, which I did it at like,
you did it for like 2.5 hours last night.
Yeah, but that was at midnight and it was kind of like a test stream. It didn't count.
Of viewers and got lots of subscribers, so don't sell yourself short.
You can find me on Twitter at SuitUpSully, where I basically post wherever I'm going to be each day. Somehow I've been roped into more live streams and more stuff than I could possibly keep up with. So I don't know where I'll be. You'll find me.
All right. Wherever he is, guys, you will find him. And I am, of course, Brandon Hanna. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at BrandonHanna07. You can, of course, find me here at youtube.com/BrandonHanna, guys. And if I didn't say it before, because I think I forgot, please hit that like button, subscribe, hit that little notification bell so you never miss out on any of this periodic table goodness, or when I do eventually release that Film Physics Christmas special. Leave a comment down below. Let me know your thoughts. What do you think about sea worms, ancient sea worms, modern sea worms, sea shanty earworms? I want to get all your collective thoughts, just like the Borg. And I feel like I'm forgetting something. I guess I can look at Patreon again, patreon.com/BrandonHanna. Please give me your money for very little in return. Once again, thank you so much for joining us for another amazing episode of the Periodic Table. So much fun having these two amazing guests here. And as I end this show every single week, thank you for taking time out of your day.